I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Megan Thee Stallion is one of the biggest stars in hip-hop today. From a recent collaboration with Cardi B to a major endorsement deal with Revlon to her song Savage taking over TikTok, it's been a banner year for the rapper. But her success also comes with a harsh reminder that misogyny is still rampant in the music industry. Recently, Stallion became the target of ridicule after publicly speaking out about being a victim of gun violence.
I'm not gonna let y'all keep playing in my face. So, since y'all hold so worry about it, Corey shot me. You shot me. And you got your publicists and your people going to these blogs lying. Stop lying.
That was Megan on Instagram in early August, where she identified rapper Tory Lanez as the person who shot her. Initially, few celebrities and musicians came to her defense, with some even mocking or dismissing the traumatic incident, and others dubbing her a snitch. For more on this, we're joined by Karen Atiyah, a global opinions editor at The Washington Post, and Elizabeth Mendez Berry, the vice president and executive editor of One World Books. Karen and Elizabeth, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Karen, what was the initial response to Megan's shooting, both on social media and from within the hip-hop industry?
Yeah, so, you know, Megan was actually shot earlier in the summer, and there was footage, even video of her coming out of a black car, and she's bleeding from her feet on the pavement. And at first, we didn't know. She said that she'd been shot. She said it on social media, but we didn't know who did it. And initially, there was chatter on the social media, but it wasn't really picked up, you know, by larger mainstream media. And then fast forward, you know, Tory Lanez gets arrested, still speculation that maybe he was the one that shot her. And then when she finally came out earlier this month and directly said that it was Tory Lanez, that's when even still the response has still been one of, if not, you know, kind of ignoring the story, of not believing Megan, of saying she did something to deserve it, of saying that she was running around with the wrong crowd anyway, and just victim blaming. And it's just been really, you know, tragic to see, despite, as your intro said, she's had quite a successful year.
You know, this sadly is not new. Elizabeth, in 2005, you explored the links between cases of intimate partner violence among Black and Latina women and hip hop artists like Big Pun, for example. Can you tell us briefly about Pun and his wife?
Yeah. So Big Pun had been extremely abusive with his wife, Liza, and they had been together since they were 16 years old, which is when he actually started hitting her. And so after his passing, she was confronted with the possibility of continuing to be, you know, the first lady of Latino hip hop or telling the truth about who he had been and what he had done to her in its fullness, because she wasn't, you know, just critiquing him. She was trying to tell a story about cycles of violence and how they permeate our communities. And she did that ultimately because her children were replicating the violence that Pun had subjected her to. Her little son was beating up her daughters. And so as a result, she came forward, she told her story, and she was not only vilified and ostracized, but she was financially cut off by Fat Joe and others in the music industry, to the point where she eventually was in a homeless shelter and was forced to sell Pun's jewelry to survive.
Karen, let's talk a little bit about what your column talks about, which is some of the barriers that women of color, Black women in hip hop and beyond, face when they're trying to talk about this type of intimate partner violence. What did Megan face in her case?
Yeah, you know, especially when she named Tory Lanez, she faced a lot. She did get a lot of support, you know, particularly from Black female celebrities. But people were calling her a snitch, a liar, a snitch, as if she was involved in some sort of crime ring along with Tory Lanez. She had just released her WAP video, which had been, which shot up to the charts, right? But was also criticized for being sexually explicit. And so part of it is this notion that sexually liberated Black women are less deserving, less worthy of protection. So people were, I saw on social media, people were looking for all sorts of reasons to try to explain why we should ignore what happened to her, you know, a bit of respectability politics in there. And so it's really, in a way, tragic that she had to kind of, not exactly beg to be believed, but that she had to come out and, in the middle of her trauma, she had to go and to the hospital to get the bullets removed from her feet and have to just say, yes, believe me, please. And so I think the message is, like, if a famous, wealthy Black woman at, you know, reaching the heights of her career needs to fight to be believed, how much more so for Black women who, normal Black women, everyday Black women. And so I think that's what's so disturbing, why I wanted to write the column, is just to draw attention to this.
Elizabeth, when you were doing your work in 2005, you found that many of the victims of abuse that you talked to were afraid to come forward. When you hear the story about Megan Thee Stallion, does it sound familiar to you from your work back then?
Yeah, absolutely. I was just going to say that. I mean, I think that the accusations that she is experiencing are so similar to what I witnessed, whether the woman was better known, whether she was lesser known. And actually, that they're the kind of accusations that regular people foist at other regular people in their own lives when somebody, you know, when a relationship abuse comes up. And so it's like a broken record, you know. And I think one of the things that is really interesting about this moment is that Megan has the opportunity to speak out herself, right? She's actually telling her story on her own terms. In 2005, when I wrote this piece, you know, many, many, many people chose not to come forward because they were afraid. And so, you know, I do, the fact that we're having this conversation on the radio right now, the fact that Megan is as prominent as she prominent now as she is, all of that gives me some hope. But I also think that misogyny is extremely persistent and extremely agile.
I want to bring up the fact that in Megan has said, quote, he shot me and I still tried to protect him because the police be killing us. And there's a difficult choice that Megan talked about there, being afraid for her own safety, but also fearing that if she calls the police, and particularly women of color, Black women and Latina women, if we call the police on Black or Latino men, we risk not just snitching, but putting those men into a criminal justice system that already over polices communities of color. Can both of you talk a little bit about that tension, Karen and Elizabeth?
Yeah, Karen here. So absolutely. And I think that is what was so heartbreaking in many ways about what's happening or what happened to Megan, especially like in this year where police brutality against Black people and, you know, people of color, the Latinx community is in such sharp relief. All of America is watching what can happen to Black men who can get killed by police. So, I mean, in many ways, she has, this is just something that we keep in mind. And I know of other women who have thought about this. At the same time, it's like, that's the conundrum that many Black women face, is putting our safety and our security last, or being expected to, and basically protecting our abusers because we live in a racist society.
Elizabeth, your thoughts on that? Did you find that in your reporting as well?
Absolutely. I think it's a huge challenge. And I think one of the things, you know, as Karen suggested, is that as we start, you know, at the nexus of the Me Too movement and the Black Lives Matter movement is the fact that, you know, among police abuses, one of them is, you know, domestic violence rates are very elevated among police officers, likewise sexual abuse. And so the question is, how do we imagine justice and accountability in our communities outside of a criminal justice system? And as it stands, what they often, instead of doing that, what we do is just ignore and pretend it didn't happen. But I think we have a real opportunity here. And I think that will be sort of the next pivot for us, is what is justice, especially in cases of sexual violence and physical violence, gender-based violence, without relying on the criminal justice system.
Karen, what do we do what's the role of the industry here, or fans, in terms of calling out this type of behavior, but actually trying to make change within the community?
I think what Elizabeth just said about other ways of justice is a really interesting point. I mean, I think about some of the other Black women in hip hop who have massive fan bases, like the Bayhive or Rihanna's Navy. And I think part of what should happen or should have happened is that more people in the industry should have called out Tory Lanez, should have called for a boycott, should have imposed way more professional and reputational consequences, and conversely, perhaps a campaign to support Megan and to rally behind Megan. That's what I wish could have been seen, and which I think could have sent a huge message about what justice, restoration, and support could look like in this case.
Karen Atiyah is the Global Opinions Editor at The Washington Post, and Elizabeth Mendez-Berry is the Vice President and Executive Editor at One World Books. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And if you or someone you know has experienced domestic abuse or needs support, call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. Or text LOVEIS to 22522.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.